Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. The women of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force have been ever present in our media since the Second World War, whether it's Susanna York in the Battle of Britain film, or the ever-present WAFs with the headsets on, pushing the counters for the German raids coming in. The WAF in public memory has a very specific role, that one within the RAF filter room. But who were the women that joined the Women's Auxiliary Air Force? And what did they actually get up to? Was it just working the radar and pushing German raids around the plotting board? In her new book, The Women Behind the Few, war historian Dr. Sarah Louise Miller looks at the Women's Auxiliary Air Force throughout its life in the Second World War, and the women who not only were working in RAF sector rooms and at radar stations, but in the Y service and in photo reconnaissance, amongst other places. The book is absolutely fantastic as it delves into the women, their personalities, and the struggles that they had to face during their service in the Second World War. But I'd love to know how she started and what was the starting point that sent her looking at the WAFs.
Well, it's actually quite a funny story. It was totally unintentional. My husband bet me when I was an undergraduate £20 that I couldn't get Captain America into my thesis, my third year thesis. And I am a sucker for a bet, so I took it. And I was originally going to do it on the Boston Tea Party, which there's no way you can get Captain America into that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to have a look what else I could do. Ended up at the Imperial War Museum at, they had an exhibition called Secret War. And they had some items pertaining to the Special Operations Executive. So I looked it up and did a bit of digging. And it turned out that Captain America's girlfriend, Peggy Carter, was an SOE agent. So not only did I get Captain America into my dissertation, I got a picture of his girlfriend by talking about kind of representations of women in intelligence and espionage in popular culture. So I won the bet, I won £20, but I also got an entire career out of it because I then got really intrigued by the SOE. So mainly by, they had a dress and a satchel with a blood stain on it in this exhibition. Mm-hmm. So I read up on them. It turned out they had belonged to Yvonne Cormeau, who is in the book. She was an SOE agent, but she was also a WAF. The bloodstain was from, she'd been shot in the leg while trying to escape a German roadblock when she was deployed as an agent in occupied France. And I just thought, wow, this is really, really interesting. So I started reading, did my dissertation, won my 20 quid, got a first and thought, I don't need to carry on with this. So I found out that she was just one of a handful of WAF who'd served in the SOE. So I thought, okay, well, what else did the WAF do then? Did an MPhil, which was on the WAF, and that is now in your hands as a book, that piece of work.
Right. And it is an absolutely fascinating tale. And we're sort of going to pick out a few bits of it. And I guess that the thing that always strikes me with the story of British women at war is that they were so involved come the end of the First World War and then cast aside, basically, and until the Second. So there were women in uniform in the interwar period. What were they doing? Were they doing the same sort of roles that they were doing before, or were they being shunted into slightly less glamorous things?
Well, so we did have, like you said, we did have women in uniform in the First World War. We had the WAC, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. It's about 50,000 of them in the army by the end of the war. The Women's Royal Air Force actually was founded the same time as the Royal Air Force. A lot of people don't know that. And they had about 15,500 women by 1918, or the end of 1918. And then the WRENS, the Women's Royal Naval Service, about 5,500. So that's a good number of women in military uniform. But unfortunately, the services are all disbanded, sometimes slowly. They retain a number of them to help wind down the war. But it was an uncomfortable thing to see. The British authorities had only begrudgingly agreed to put women in uniform, and they didn't want to keep them that way. So it was very much a back to the kitchen type situation. And a lot of them have spoken in their sort of memoirs and diaries about how sad that was for them, because they'd achieved independence outside of the home, and then they have to give that up for men to take their roles in the peacetime military back. And the women are sort of back to normal, as it were. And that's a shame, because they very much set a precedent, and it was not easily forgotten. So, you know, that their contribution in World War One is resonating throughout the interwar period. It doesn't fade away. People remember seeing them in those uniforms. So when you get to the point where World War Two seems inevitable, that memory is still there.
So that view of them was lingering, but at the same time, not overly palatable with the sort of culture that was in Britain during that time. Because come Munich, things change a lot as everything is ramping up towards rearmament.
Yeah, it's they're always seen as kind of subversive. You've got these kind of socially acceptable roles, separate spheres ideology, which is Victorian, really, this idea that women nurture. And that's why it's usually completely acceptable to see women in nursing roles, even if it's at the front line. We don't want to see women at the front line in the First World War and even in the Second, because that's not where they belong. We don't want to put women in danger. But if they're nurses, that's okay, because they're inside of their socially acceptable role as nurturers, as caregivers. So when you put them in a military uniform and make them do something that is not supposed to be done by a woman, that is subversive. And that's uncomfortable. And it's not just uncomfortable for the British authorities and the military. Some women are resistant to it. And especially when you get into the Second World War, when you start to see women in uniform, mothers become angry, because they'll look at a woman in uniform and go, well, if you've got that uniform on, you've taken a role on the home front, that means my son is being sent overseas to die, potentially. So you get kind of pushback even from women. It's not seen as this kind of feminist advance. It's very much out of necessity. And it's quite begrudging in some ways by society and by the authority.
So let's get into some specifics. So what was the Women's Auxiliary Air Force? Now, I'm going to draw into my usual bag of tricks and say my first experience of the WAFs were Susanna York in the Battle of Britain movie, and that's kind of where it started. But what was the Women's Auxiliary Air Force when it was formed, and what was that sort of original plan for it? Was it just really to backfill, or was it broader?
It was It was meant to substitute. So the clue's in the name, auxiliary. I looked up the word auxiliary because I think it's a really interesting view into why this service existed and what was expected of it. So if you look up auxiliary, you get words like supplementary, substitute. It's the idea was they are meant to substitute for men who are needed in combat roles. Women are restricted to non-combat. So we can send the men off for combat service and the women will substitute. That's the word that you see over and over in the National Archives files. And they even have rates of substitution. And sometimes they'll substitute two or three women for one man. Because, you know, it's going to take two people to do a man's job with less training and less experience. So they're very much seen as a kind of supplement to the RAF rather than at that point, rather than integrally, you know, involved.
That's surprising because, again, as we said at the beginning, women did a sterling service beforehand and some of that lingered. But when it restarts again, that's kind of forgotten and they're just a third of a man, which seems remarkable.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to take, actually, when you're researching it and you see these posters and some of the recruitment posters are indicative of that. Their attitude, come and relieve a man to fight type thing. That's your only value to the RAF, to relieve a man to fight. It didn't stop them from wanting to. They were so proud, most of those early recruits, and there were thousands who immediately, some of them 17 and a half years old, they're at the very minimum age and they need their parents' permission to join up. They felt so strongly that they went off to do it. And they know they're relieving what is essentially a manpower vacuum, manpower situation. They're okay with it at that point. I love that quote. I think it's Eleanor Roosevelt, where she says, women are like tea bags. You don't know how strong they are until you put them in hot water. And I think the WAF at that point were not unexpected of being put in very hot water, but couldn't possibly have guessed what was ahead of them. And I think, you know, this manpower situation was just the tip of the iceberg, and they, as we'll see, and hopefully as comes across in the book, they did go on to prove that they were incredibly strong. Goodness knows what kind of tea that would have made.
So before we start looking into three of the areas that you look at in the book, one of the questions I had, now I wrote this in my notes and I may have got it wrong. Did you say that they were paid 20% of what a normal RAF rating would have been paid? Or was that 20% less like the ATA were?
It varies. So when I first started this research, obviously when you start any kind of research on the military in the Second World War, you're going to go to the National Archives at Kew. I had an inkling from my undergraduate dissertation that I might not find everything I needed there. What I found was interesting. So there's lots and lots of files on arguments over pay. They're consistently paid less than men, and that's not unusual. Everything about their service was different to their parent service, the RAF. So their ranking system, their promotional structures, recognition and awards, everything was pretty much different, and the pay is too. It's frustrating, and in some ways, you know, nothing's really changed. In some parts of today's world, let's not go there. But yeah, it's pretty much consistently a lot less than the men are paid. Some other files on that point, my favourite files about the WAF in the National Archives, are big, thick files over the arguments over whether or not they should be allowed to wear trousers when working as aircraft mechanics, because they keep tearing their skirts climbing in and out of aircraft, which I think is a hilarious thing to have a big fat argument of a file over, but nonetheless.
That does seem a very RAF argument, though.
Yes.
You see some of these files that you think, oh, this is going to be great, but then you realize it's definition of why a certain role is going to be posted to the north of England and only for the north of England and not exactly why you wanted it. So an argument over trousers seems within keeping, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's why we've had to draw so heavily on personal testimony, Imperial War Museum records, you know, look elsewhere, because it's so, the RAF files are so concerned with these issues that don't allow you to get into talking about what did they do, though? What was their intelligence work? What did it consist of? And what impact did it have? So in some ways, those files are revealing. They tell us about the pay issues, and that's something that a lot of social historians have looked at with the women's services, which is why I chose not to go too far into it, because it has been done very well by other people. And we have to remember those things where the WAF's concerned. They're important points.
Well, let's get into it. I'm going to go with my favorite bit of it, which is radar.
That's my favorite bit too.
Is it? Oh, fantastic. Yeah. In that case, maybe we should move it to the end. But but let's get into it. Because the thing I thought was really interesting in your book was, it's a new technology. It's new to everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that in all aspects of it, whether it's from the filter rooms through to the use of it, women are ever present in it. So did the fact that it was new help women to get assigned to, say, the radar stations themselves? Or is it just a general lack of manpower for them?
It's a general lack of manpower. I think it's fortuitous in some ways, because it has to be based in Britain. And that's where the women are allowed to serve. That's where they're restricted to serve initially. They do go on to serve overseas. But in the time where radar is critically important in the Battle of Britain, they are working at home. And radar has to be based at home. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of in that respect, it may be why there were so many of them involved in that work. Interestingly, they wouldn't be the first choice purely and simply because they were not educated in maths and science to the point where men were. They did needlework and cooking and useful domestic things at school, and they were not required, or in some cases allowed, to take maths and science at school to a very high level. And obviously, I'm sure you know of things about radar. I have had to learn things about radar. It is not very easy if you don't understand the things like physics and math, because there's a lot of calculations and stuff involved. So it was something where they wouldn't necessarily have been the first group of people that the RAF went, oh, you'll do, because you've got the right, you know, training. It was more a case of, oh, you're here, we can train you pretty quickly. And that's what they had to do. And that technology, as you rightly just said, a lot of men had never clapped eyes on before. So it's very novel for this group of women to have to use this technology that's so new, it's fresh out of the box. And they have to learn on the job, and they have to learn fast.
So what jobs are they going to be doing in the radar net? Because it's, you know, we're not going to go into all the chain load and home and all those good things, or how it works, because that's going to show me up more than anything else. It's my show, and we don't do that on my show. But what roles were they doing? Because, yeah, the classic thing from all of those movies at the time is the women with the big headsets pushing the counters around. But they're doing a lot more than that. So what roles are they filling in the stations themselves?
So the interesting thing here is, you know, most people know about radar and the importance of radar in the Second World War. I would say most people who know things about the Battle of Britain and the Second World War, but what the real secret was, and this was from the Germans as well, happily, in the war, was the Dowding system. So radar is the technology, and Dowding system is this, it's the world's first integrated air defense system, and it's the system in which this technology is deployed. The technology in and of itself would have had WAF sat on cliff tops in radar, coastal radar stations, accumulating information about incoming Luftwaffe raids. If it were not for the Dowding system, that information would not have gone anywhere, and it would not have resulted in anything. So when we say integrated, this integrated air defense system, we're talking about different components of air defense working together very, very effectively. It's very sophisticated. So it starts at those clifftop radar stations. So you've got WAF, often in quite precarious positions, sometimes even in caravans on the edges of very windy cliffs. I was in Dover a few weeks ago, and the wind on those cliffs, I was thinking, goodness, that's so dangerous. And you've got these 360-foot radar towers, which are obviously there, so the Luftwaffe can see them. So, you know, it's a bit of a hairy place to be. And they've got their radar technology. So that's looking out to sea. And it can pick up, it sends out, loosely speaking, it sends out a beam that is then hits an aircraft and is reflected back. And when it's received by the WAF and the radar station, they can basically record certain pieces of information about the raid, and it might be a friendly group of aircraft, it might be ours, and that prevents, you know, friendly fire. It might be an enemy raid, and that is much more serious. So you can tell approximate altitude, number of aircraft in the incoming raid, heading, bearing, various bits of information that are obviously useful in intercepting and downing that raid. That information needs to go ultimately to a fighter squadron that can be scrambled, or an anti-aircraft artillery site that can be activated to deal with this raid. So how does it do it? It's going to go through this system of processes, and there are WAF involved at every point. So first of all, it's going to go from the coastal radar site to Bentley Priory, Fighter Command's headquarters, to their filter room. And I was at Bentley Priory a few weeks ago, which is a really great museum now, actually. And it does a way better job of explaining all of this than I will, so thoroughly recommend. But basically, it goes into the filter room at Bentley Priory. So there's some WAF in there. They have to filter this information because it's essentially kind of raw scientific data at this point. So filtering is removing anomalies, and it's making the data make sense. It then goes next door to Bentley Priory's operations room, and that is where Air Chief Marshal Sir Hugh Dowding is watching the progress of the battle. That information, you just talked about the ladies with the headsets on. There's a big map on a central table that covers the UK. And the ladies with the headsets on, who are stood around the table, are doing one of the most stressful jobs that I think anyone had to do in the Battle of Britain. They are plotting, which means they're putting little counters on the map to depict information about the incoming raid. And through the headset, they're listening to the radar site. So they're listening to a WAF on a radar site saying, this is what is coming. Then they're doing with their little, and they look like casino croupier sticks. They're poking counters around the map. They're moving them. They're putting real-time intelligence on a map. So the RAF brass, usually Dowding's in there, can see with a delay of, you know, maybe 2 to 5 minutes, what is actually happening throughout the Battle of Britain. It's real-time intelligence. It's then going to go from there to a group operations room. So the RAF's kind of geographic reach is split into various groups. They've all got operations rooms. And inside of them, there are sectors. They've all got operations rooms. So you get through the system. And then at every point through this system, you've got WAF in communications. And we must not forget the importance of communications, because women form the backbone of communications in the military services. And without them, no information goes anywhere. So this information reaches a sector operations room, and they are the point at which you will scramble fighter squadrons, or you will activate an anti-aircraft artillery site, or you will sound an air raid siren and act on that intelligence. So it has to go through this big system. And there are WAF involved in basically every part. And I think that's just amazing. The cohesiveness of that is just brilliant.
And it is decisive, isn't it? That chain of command never broke. There was moments when it went a little bit darker than it should have, but it was there, and it was kept running by the women of the WAF, which is fantastic. Now, there is a line in your book which made me very happy when I read it on the plane, which was Robert Watson Watt, the man who invented radar. Well, perfected it for use within the Dowding system. He said it was the anti-ham-fistedness of women made them ideal for being radar operators. I thought that was a wonderful line from someone who knew the precision that was needed to operate his kit and who was best for that job.
Yeah, he also said he thought women were quite good at it because they were good darners of socks. So make of that what you will. And there's a lovely word also, yes, that was used in recruitment for plotting, and it was unflappability, which I really like. We're looking for unflappable women.
And they were. And we're going to get more into that now, because we're going to pivot over from sort of sending radio waves out and listening in on them, which is the Y service, which has always fascinated me. Because we hear very much about Bletchley Park. You're there on Saturday, of course, for your launch. But what was the Y service, and really, how does the WAF sort of fit into something? I guess, you know, we think of Bletchley, we think of the Navy and people like that, but how did the WAF fit into this, and how did women in the Secret Service get seen, really?
The WAF service is, frustratingly, it's always just below the surface of what we see and hear. I think it's kind of bubbled for a bit. We've had the odd kind of look at it in some books and some work that's been coming out. But it's been kind of lurking there for a while. And you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, Bletchley would have had absolutely nothing to do if it wasn't for the WAF service. We all hear about, you know, famous Alan Turing and Gordon Welchman, some of the other Josh Cooper, some of the Codebreakers, who were there doing fantastic work. And none of this is ever to take away from those individuals. But purely and simply wouldn't have had anything to do if it weren't for the WAF service, because you can't decrypt or decode information that you don't have. So the WAF service is essentially a listening service. It's got different sort of sections. So each military service has a section, and the civilian intelligence services have sections, and their focus is obviously on their counterpart. So the RAF section of the WAF service is concerned with Luftwaffe communications. So you've got WAF and members of the RAF posted in what they call Y listening stations around Britain and its territories, listening to Luftwaffe communications, radio communications, either air-to-air, air-to-ground. Sometimes they actually manage to pick up on panzer divisions as well, so they could hear tanks talking to each other. But it's hard. I mean, I recently had a go on a mock kind of radio set, and it was really tough. I think the toughest thing for me was the noise, the background noise, the interference from weather, and trying to, you know, tune and tune and tune until you can actually hear voices or Morse code or a rate. Sometimes it was plain voice messages, sometimes it was a Morse code. But trying to actually pick that out of all the interference and the feedback was actually really tricky. So it meant sitting there for hours trying to tune into a message. And then as soon as you get it down as quickly as possible. And sometimes that meant being able to understand German if it was a voice message. So the WAF service is very much looking for women who can speak German or understand German. You're going to tune in to a frequency, write down everything you can hear. So you need to understand Morse code and possibly German. Write it down as quickly as you can in as much detail as you can, because if you miss anything, it literally could cost lives. So that's, you know, all of this work, all I keep thinking about is, could I take that kind of pressure? Well, I really don't think I could. I mean, I guess it goes back to the teabag, but you don't know, do you, until you're in hot water. But it was tough work and long nights. In these kind of often quite remote WAF stations, desperately trying to tune into messages that, you know, could be the difference between life and death.
And for someone who's never listened to a high frequency transmission, back in the day, we used to have to talk to our aircraft who are a long way away on them. And it's like looking through fog, really, isn't it? It's just noise that there'll be a voice or something coming over. It is so hard. And the thought of listening to that for a whole shift is terrifying, because you must take your headphones off and all you can hear is the
shh. 100%.
It would be awful. But they did it, and they kept feeding Bletchley. But there's a wonderful bit in your book, and I sort of merged the questions together, which was my bad, which was the security services themselves that were running Bletchley, the Y service. We would know them now as MI5, MI6, and the other ones that popped up during the war. But how did they view, because we sort of talked about the RAF's view of them, the idea that a woman can't keep a secret. That, I guess that for a security service was one that they, to be diplomatic, struggled with to get their heads around.
Yes, it was a pretty general idea, actually. Everything was so compartmentalized in British intelligence. It had to be for secrecy reasons. More of the picture you can see, the more of the picture you can give away. So keep it compartmentalized, and it ensures a higher level of secrecy and reduces damage if anything does get out. And that meant that the services and the sections didn't really have that much to do with each other. But there is this consistent idea across most of them. And I would say even in public that women were a bit gossipy, loose-lipped. You can see it in the propaganda, which we do have a look at in the book. We've got the Fugas series, Careless Talk Costs Lives. And you've got nattering ladies on buses with German high command sitting behind them listening. And you've got the Keep Mum, She's Not So Dumb.
Yes.
You've got
the one in your book of the lady in the cocktail dress, isn't it? With the officers standing behind her. And that's the one, isn't it? Yeah.
It's fascinating because, you know, I came across some documents about Bletchley, and there's a guy who's down the pub boasting about this secret work he's doing up at the mansion that he's not supposed to talk about, but he is, to a group of women. But in that instance, it's the women who are seen as subversive. Because if women are present in a pub with servicemen, they're luring information out. He's volunteering it, you know, and he was sacked for it and faced consequences. But it's still their fault because their subversive presence in the pub made him do it. So it's definitely I think it obviously stems from, you know, Mata Hari, the idea of the femme fatale spy seductress. Mata Hari was an exotic dancer during the First World War who sort of slept her way through the German high command and was executed for espionage and treason. And it just left this bad taste in the mouth about women in secret work. They're not trustworthy. They cannot be trusted. They should not be trusted. And that didn't go away. Obviously, you know, they proved it wrong. The WAF and all the other women who worked in intelligence, not to say there weren't any secrecy breaches because of women, but overwhelmingly, they waited a lot longer than men did to talk about their war service. You see a lot more male memoirs pop up before female ones do. And I have personally spoken to veterans, 98-year-old lady I interviewed recently, and trying to get anything out of her on operational intelligence was like getting blood out of a stone. This is decades after the war. She's been released from her oath, but she said to me, no, I remember signing the Official Secrets Act. There was a gun on the table next to it, and we were told, you do not talk about this work. And they took that so seriously that it made my life very difficult during the course of this research.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum among our collection of kamikaze aircraft. We have two versions of the Oka, which was a suicide rocket-powered human-guided bomb. This version here is the two-seat trainer version. We made a couple of them that were launched on a catapult with one rocket engine that they would use to train potential Oka pilots. You have the instructor in the back and the student up front. It technically could glide and they could land it back on the skid and, you know, learn how to fly the operational version of the aircraft. It also had a longer wingspan to allow it to perform as a glider. The operational Oka right over here, which is on loan from the Royal Air Force Museum. The trainer version is actually on loan from the National Air and Space Museum. The operational Oka was an anti-shipping human-guided suicide bomb. It would be loaded underneath a Japanese G4M Betty bomber. It would be launched, had three rockets in the back, if I recall correctly, and really only had about less than a minute, only maybe it was about 20 or 30 seconds worth of actual flight time. And then it would kind of go into a terminal dive on a ship guided by the suicide or kamikaze pilot flying the aircraft. They weren't all that successful, not because of the design itself. The biggest problem being the fact that they were strapped on a Japanese Betty. They had to get within about 20 miles of the American fleet, which meant most of them were shot down while still strapped on the Japanese bomber. But they did have a few successes off of Okinawa. So the aircraft behind it is a Nakajima Ki-115 Tsurugi, which is another purpose-built kamikaze aircraft. during the war, the majority of kamikaze aircraft leading up to, you know, the end of the war were mostly repurposed aircraft. So Zeros, Oscars, Bettys, Bells, etc. With the Tsurugi, the Japanese Army Air Service was building an aircraft specifically designed from bottom up as a one-way mission kamikaze suicide special attack force aircraft. The wings are made out of aluminum. The fuselage is essentially made out of metal that's no different than you'd have in air ducting. That's why it's kind of rusted. The inside of the cockpit is all very rudimentary with like wooden, made out of wood, wood control stick and throttle, maybe three or four gauges at best. The landing gear actually dropped off the aircraft so that they could repurpose them. Also, you know, it kind of forced, I will say it probably also forced the Japanese pilot onto his, to complete his mission or attempt to complete his mission. Because once you drop the landing gear, the explosive or bomb that's armed underneath your aircraft, you're not exactly going to be able to belly land that aircraft without destroying yourself in the aircraft. But this was kind of shows just like how desperate the Japanese were getting at the end of the war, just making these mass-produced, kind of like simple-built aircraft, just so they could have the sheer numbers for them for the what they expected to be the decisive invasion of Japan with the first in Kyushu and then Honshu. But because of the dropping of the atomic bombs in Hirohito, realizing that they could not go on any longer, that they decided to surrender to the United States, or in the Allies, I should say.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And we're back with Dr. Sarah Louise Miller discussing the women behind the few. You've got a group called the Secret Six, which is just the most wonderful title for a group of women within intelligence. Who were they? Sort of briefly, we don't want to spoil it too much. Go on, read the book. There's loads about them. But who were the Secret Six? Because I fell a bit in love with them. They were fab.
I do like the Secret Six. Yeah, basically, so it was a lot of the time during the Second World War, it wasn't kind of an immediate thing to be identified as an intelligence officer. You might be doing what was essentially intelligence work, but the Secret Six are the first kind of, you know, really visible in the service anyway, intelligence officers in the WAF. So there are six women from the WAF who serve in the Y service, obviously as intelligence officers. One of them is one of my personal favorite women in the book, Eileen Clayton. She's fascinating. I'll come back to her in a second. Barbara Pemberton was one of the Secret Six. She was later awarded an MBE for her work with the unit. One of my other favorites, the Honorable Mrs. Jeffrey Pearson, was actually fairly deaf. And I don't know if that's like a good thing or a bad thing if you're working in the White House, because on the upside, the interference and the background noise is probably going to bother her less. But on the other, can she hear what's being transmitted? She must have done a good job because she was one of the six, but she spoke very good German, so they snapped her up. But Eileen is just wonderful. She's actually the first WAF to be commissioned for intelligence duties in July 1940, so Battle of Britain. Fairly hairy time to be told you're the first WAF, go do intelligence work. But she did, and she did so very, very well and very interestingly. One of my personal favourite stories about her, though, in a particularly hairy raid during the Battle of Britain, there's a lot of bombing going on. Her superior officer, RAF officer, started to get a bit hysterical. So the RAF had been worried that the WAF, this group of women, were going to get emotional, hysterical. And her superior RAF officer got a bit kind of, you know, frazzled and hysterical. So she just made a judgment call and went up and slapped him right across the face, hard. No one said anything. They all just returned to work. Apparently it worked. And she worried for days that there'd be repercussions, but there weren't. And I just think that's a really good way to solve a situation like that. And I wish I could do that sometimes.
The work that they did is remarkable. And it, you know, like I said, they kind of get lost behind Turing and the others. But what's the lasting impact of the WAFs within the Y service? Because, as you said, they've taken it so seriously that even now they're still unwilling to be as free with what they got up to. So what's been the impact of them sort of more broadly?
Their impact at the time was massive. Like we've said, you know, Bletchley couldn't function without them. And people at Bletchley have admitted that. Asa Briggs in his work, he was based at Bletchley Park. He said a few times, we just wouldn't have had anything to work on. You know, they were absolutely vitally necessary to what happened at Bletchley and to other forms of intelligence. Because a lot of time, you know, intelligence coming in from different directions in the wider picture, and it's helping, corroborating, disproving all over the place. So the Y Service has its fingers in lots of pies. And their impact was massive. But it was, you know, one of the reasons I called this book The Women Behind the Few is because the women were behind the few in terms of supporting them. You know, like, we're behind you, we've got you. But at the same time, they're behind them in terms of historical memory. And the Y Service, I think, is a really good example of that, because they were behind so many operations, so many instances where intelligence was vitally useful, but never really got the recognition that they deserved. And their work was so important, and it's a real shame to me that they've been kind of omitted. And I think that's improving slowly. We're starting to look behind closed doors now, and I hope that we manage to get more and more stuff out there on them.
Agreed. That'll be wonderful. Now, our last sort of quick look at the WAFs are going to be the ones that I probably know a little bit more about, which is the ones that were involved with photo interpretation at RAF Medmenden. So what was going on there? Because this is much like radar, it is completely new to the RAF in the volume that they're going to be operating in. So how did the WAFs get involved with photo interpretation? I suppose, what is photo interpretation for those that don't know? But yeah, looking at a photo and understanding what it is the basic. But what were they doing to understand these reams of photos that were coming back from the PRU?
Well, when I first read about photo interpretation, I thought, well, that sounds like a nice job, actually. We'll sit there and have a look at some photos and make some notes. And then I looked at some aerial photos and I was like, okay, I see why the word interpretation has been used here, because it is basically a form of decoding. If you've ever seen an aerial photo, because they're often taken from pretty much a bird's eye view, so straight down or oblique or, you know, slightly angled, still really hard to read, to tell what you're actually seeing, because they just look like blobs. It looks like Lego. And I was at Daintfield's house a few weeks ago, which was RAF Medmenham in the Second World War, and they've still got a number of photos. And it's just shapes. Mm-hmm. So really, photo interpretation is looking at aerial reconnaissance photos that have been taken from thousands of feet in the air and trying to make head or tail of what you're actually looking at. You know, with most of these forms of intelligence, it's quite obvious why this information is useful. Photo interpretation is very useful because you've got first-hand information on the enemy's intentions and capabilities. If you see a build-up of troops or tanks, it's fairly, you know, indicative that their intention is to invade or push into somewhere. Or, you know, if there is a lot of activity in a built-up area that there wasn't before, maybe they're working on a new kind of technology. It's just deducing information from what you're physically seeing on pictures. And that meant flying thousands of sorties or flights, aerial reconnaissance flights, with special cameras attached to the bottom of modified aircraft, which the pilots hated because the film was very flammable, so put them in a lot more danger. Those planes come back after their reconnaissance sorties, and it's often WAF who are taking that film off the plane. Then they take it off and develop it. And that's actually, some of them got poisoned through the chemicals in that, involved in that process. Then the photos had to be kind of sent to the right people. So you'd end up building up expertise. So you might have someone who had particular expertise in looking at airfields or looking at aircraft or ships, whatever. Someone, if you spend hours and hours and hours looking at the same thing, you do begin to build up kind of a specialism or expertise in it. So the pictures had to go to a section that was best placed to deal with them. So, for instance, you had the airfield section, and then it's a case of poring over them. And we're talking millions of prints by the end of the war, an archive of millions and millions of pictures, to look at anything that might be useful. And that often meant looking at them 24 hours apart. So you could have pictures taken one night, and then the next, and then the next. And what's changed? Because that's what's going to give you an indication of what the enemy intends. So we want a picture of, equipment or troop movement, you can see what they're capable of. But often intentions you have to guess more at. And often that was an educated guess based on what these pictures said. And WAF photo interpreters were given kind of a shopping list of things they needed to be, which was have a good visual memory, be able to sketch a lot of the time. Attention to detail. I have rubbish attention to detail. This is why I've failed so many driving tests, because I don't see details, but they had to see every detail. An inquiring mind, don't just look at something, look at it and go, why is that there? What does that mean? What has changed? And be, constantly asking questions. Curious, I love this phrase, curious in the unusual. So don't look at something and go, oh, that's weird, next picture. Look at something and go, oh, that's weird. What does it mean? What could it be? And again, they haven't studied maths and sciences. So it's fascinating, the number of them that managed to come up with ways of doing things on the job and then even write manuals that they leave for the people coming up behind them, for the next WAF who were shoved into the job. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we found this quite hard because we didn't have any of the requisite training. But here, this is how we figured out how to do it. This might help you. So they're not only rising to the occasion and doing this job, they're making it easier for people to do this job around them, which I think is just amazing.
Because there's a fantastic story of Constance Babington Smith, isn't it, who sort of pours over Jane's, pours over everything, writes the documentation and ends up in charge of the aircraft interpretation section. And famously, it was her that spotted the V1, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about, because she saw an object on a photo and it didn't make sense. And she said, what is that? And lots of people had looked at it and, had a guess. And she just couldn't let it lie. It was a team effort. And we must always remember that with intelligence, because we have this tendency to kind of isolate individuals like Alan Turing. And they get a certain amount of adulation, which it's never to say that they don't deserve the admiration that we give them. They do, but it's important to remember there are often teams involved. And with Constance Babington Smith, she had her team. But ultimately, the thing I think is really interesting about her is that she was told to let it go where the V weapons were concerned, because she took those the kind of ideas to superiors and they said, oh, it's lake dredging equipment based on where it is. And she just wasn't satisfied with that. And she said, no, I don't think it is, and carried on looking at it, comparing it. And comparing it was really useful because she could see, what changed over time, and ultimately determined that it was a pilotless aircraft on a launch ramp pointing toward London. So thank goodness she didn't just chalk it up as, lake dredging equipment. She persisted. And I think that might have been quite hard because she was a woman in a sort of male-dominated area. And she was a section head, but there weren't many WAF section heads without an RAF officer equivalent or superior rank. So she was kind of standout in that way. And a colleague of hers was very complimentary and said, Babs has sufficient strength of character, an extraordinary singleness of purpose, together with total dedication to the task, mixed in with a modicum of determination necessary to be able to assume sole command. A modicum of determination. I hope someone says that from me.
For anyone who hasn't read it, her book on her experiences is a must read for everyone. It's fantastic.
Evidence in Canberra.
And what I thought was interesting is how you sort of contrasted that with Stella Palmer's experience of, she was looking at the raid photography, seeing how effective Bomber Command were being, and she was writing reports highlighting the trouble that Bomber Command was having finding and hitting their targets. What advice was she given?
Stella Palmer felt that it's kind of a don't shoot the messenger type situation. So this is a problem all over intelligence, all through time. If a commander or a leader says we need this or we want this by way of intelligence, they're not happy with anything but that. And the RAF wants to hear we hit our targets, you know, we accomplish things, because I mean, particularly with Bomber Command, it's such a high level of loss and sacrifice. And there's almost this need that it needs to be for something, which is understandable. These guys need to be able to write home to mothers and fathers and say your son died for a good reason. But and I think that weighed very heavily on Stella and her colleagues, because they felt that they were being required to give information that at the end of the day sometimes just wasn't true. So if they gave accurate statistics after a raid, they would be kind of accused of minimizing the effects of what Bomber Command were doing, and they were often put under quite a lot of pressure from station commanders to publish reports that weren't necessarily true, saying that there had been glorious success, that was all worth it, when actually that wasn't true. So it's understandable, but it's also, it puts them in a really tricky position. I don't know how I'd have dealt with that.
And you know, that they persisted with not, I guess we'd call it sexing up a report these days, wouldn't we? That they didn't, you know, with the butt report that came later that fed into the changes that made Bomber Command so devastating later. It's a testament to them not bowing to the pressure, and in Stella's example especially. I wasn't sure if I was going to mention this, but we just need to give a quick No, we're not. We're not going to say, ladies and gentlemen, when you get the book, and you must, because it's fab, wait till you get to Edna Skeens and Faye Gillen, because their story with 146. This show's called The Damcasters, so we need to just get people to go look at the 617 Squadron story. It wasn't all Guy Gibson. He needed some help to make sure he could get to where he was going. So go check that book out, that bit out. It's fabulous. We're not going to, because we want people to buy the book.
It's a good Easter egg. It really is.
Yes. So let's start the last few questions I have for you, really, because this is sort of the impact questions. So you've been living this for a while now.
Yeah, a while too.
What's your impression of the legacy of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force? And yeah, I guess it's safe to say we have underestimated them, but do you think we've really underestimated them and maybe not given them the due that they deserve?
I think, yes, absolutely. I've come to understand why. I think if intelligence work, and I teach on intelligence national security modules, and something I'm always saying is, we only ever hear about intelligence when it's gone wrong. Mm. We hear about 9/11, massive intelligence failures, you know, that are behind disasters like that, and atrocities. We hear about it when there's a failure. If we hear about it, something has gone wrong. So with intelligence, it's not unusual to not know. And I think it's testament, actually, to how well they did their jobs that we don't know about it. It's testament to how well they did their jobs to keep it in the shadows, but it's also testament to how good they were at keeping secrets, because they didn't come out and write tons and tons of books about it and go, oh, I need to get my face all over the place as the hero of World War II. Not that anyone did, but they certainly did not do that. And I think
Fleming tried.
Don't get me started on Fleming. It's sad, but it is understandable. You also had issues like, and one thing I'm desperately trying to correct through all of my work right now is what I think has been a massive misunderstanding, sometimes even mythology, around what women did. So you have this idea that because they were sat at desks, they were doing clerical work, because that's all women did. You have the idea that because their title might have been clerk special duties, it's got the word clerk in it. So naturally they were, you know, typing, when actually they were in the Y service. And I think that, it, again, is inevitable, but it's unfortunate. So I'm on a bit of a kind of bandwagon, I suppose, at the moment, trying to disrupt that idea and dissect what they actually did, deconstruct existing ideas and reconstruct their history situated in wider war history. Because I think we have this tendency to view women's war history as peripheral and separate. It's in the title, auxiliary, supplementary. When actually, if you look at something like the Battle of Britain, and I believe personally, you know, wider instances in the war, they are not peripheral, they are mainstream. So for me, a big kind of mission with this book was mainstreaming the history of these women. It's not women's history. It's history. It's war history. And I think that while we view it as separate, it's not getting the kind of message across of the truth of what they actually did or what it meant. So I do feel quite, in case you haven't noticed, I do feel quite strongly about it. And I plan to continue hanging that.
Yeah, that has come across. Yeah, and I guess that's perfect for my last question. Really, is the impact that this has had? Because clearly, you've done the book. You've moved on. This is certainly something you continue to work on. But what has been the impact of your research so far been on you? Your passion for this has been clear to see, and it's been lovely to chat to you about it. But what's that sort of lasting impact on you when you think back to where you were when you started on this bit of research?
It's funny because it started out as a bet for 20 quid, and it has, I mean, I know it sounds corny, but it has changed my life. And everything that I do now in my career is about this kind of passionate pursuit of giving women the recognition that they deserve in history and resituating their contributions truthfully inside the history of the Second World War and history in general. And I think, you know, there's been days when I've come away from archives and I haven't been able to stop crying. And there have been days where I frightened my cat because I was giggling so hard at something a WAF wrote in a diary. I've been on a journey. And I thoroughly recommend reading servicewomen's diaries and memoirs, because they are just some of the most wonderful reading you will ever do. And you can't forget that. And I think in my everyday, you know, I've learned so much from reading their stories, and I want to say that it has changed a lot for me, and I never want to stop doing this. It's definitely my kind of life calling now, I would say.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Now, just before I do the real thank yous and we say goodbye to our dear listener, there's one more thing you have coming up. So if you're listening to this on the day of release, which will be on the day the book's out, which is the 9th of March, on the Saturday, you have a bit of an event going on, don't you?
Yes, we are launching the book at the one and only Bletchley Park. I am immensely privileged and grateful. It's just like Christmas to be able to launch this book in a place where I recently met the Bletchley Park ex-Bletchley Park historian, who said when you walk around Bletchley Park, it's like there's the ghosts of 10,000 people walking around with you. And he's absolutely right. If you've never been, definitely go. It's awesome. But to be able to launch the book there this coming Saturday the 11th is an immense privilege, and we'll be in the ballroom in the mansion at Bletchley, and I have been given a slot to talk about it, and they're going to have a hard time stopping me, I think.
Well, that's going to be fantastic. So we'll put all the details into the description as well, and we'll try to pack the room out for you. Sarah, this has been a delight. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and thank you so much for getting it over to me early so I could have a little sneaky peek. And thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful to chat to someone who's so interested.
Interested, maybe not so interesting, but there we go. I'll leave that to other people to decide. Thank you. I cannot thank Sarah enough for joining me here on the Damcasters. It's been a fantastic chat, and as I have said repeatedly through the podcast and even before the podcast, the book is absolutely fantastic. The book is released on the 9th of March, which is the same day that this podcast drops. And if you're listening to this right away, you might be able to get yourself a ticket for the Bletchley Park launch on the 11th of March, which is this Saturday, if you're listening to this before Saturday. So if you can get down there, I'm sure it's going to be a packed house because the buzz on this book has been fantastic. Sarah's going to be appearing on lots of podcasts and shows, so do check out those other ones as well, including my old friends over at History Hack. So be sure to catch her show with Beth and Alex, which I'm sure will be a riot. As always, I cannot thank everybody enough for their support of the podcast. It has been fantastic. And of course, I have to thank our main sponsor, who is the Pima Air and Space Museum. And we will have more from them at the beginning of each month coming forward with some of the content that I recorded while I was out in Arizona. So please do check out their website, which is listed in the description below, which is quite simple. It's pimaair.org. But be sure to also pick up a copy of Sarah's book, which is on the Boney Abroad Pod bookshop. Link in the description below. If you're in the UK, a little bit of each sale goes to supporting the podcast and, of course, supporting Sarah and her continued work, which we're really excited for too. If you like this, there's a Patreon, £3 a month plus VAT, but I know times are tough. The best way to do, just leave a review for the pod, tell us whether you like it or not, and what we need to improve. What I need to improve, as I'm the person who kind of does it all. But regardless of that, thank you ever so much for listening. Pick up a copy of Sarah's book. It is wonderful. You will not regret it. And I look forward to having her back in the future for whatever she does next. Thanks so much. And as always, do take care of yourselves. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone. And it is a Boney Abroad's podcast production. To check out our other podcasts, head to boneyabroad.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.